The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In a world filled with refugees from our southern border to Greece and Turkey to Bangladesh and other locales, my guest today has written an informative and eye-opening account about the first major refugee relocation event following the end of World War II in Europe, which he says was the model for future refugee efforts in the 20th and 21st centuries. Historian David Nassau writes about the million refugees, Holocaust survivors, and yes, a great number of collaborationists and outright war criminals who were left homeless and stateless at the end of the conflict in Europe. For some, it was not wanting to return to a Soviet-dominated Eastern Europe. For Jews, it was being unable to return to homes and possessions which had been stolen, or not wanting to return to communities that had forced them out. And for others, it was to hide from their wartime actions. Nassau writes about all of these million souls who were in displaced person camps for up to 5 years after the conclusion of the war. In his book, The Last Million, Europe's Displaced Persons from World War to Cold War. David Nassau is a recently retired professor emeritus of history at the City University of New York. He's the author of a number of acclaimed books, including Children of the City, about the Newsboys strike, which was the inspiration for the film and musical Newsies. He's also written acclaimed biographies of William Randolph Hearst, Andrew Carnegie, and Joseph Kennedy. His book, The Last Million, is published by Penguin. David Nassau, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Tell us about the last million. Who were the last million?
When World War II was over, when the soldiers prepared to go home, when hostilities ceased, there were left behind in Germany several million refugees. There were prisoners of war. There were political prisoners. There were concentration camp and death camp survivors. And there were millions of slave laborers and forced laborers who the Germans had kidnapped from their homes, their villages in Eastern Europe, mostly in Poland and Ukraine, and deported to Germany to take up the work that the soldiers had left behind when they went to the Eastern Front. Guest laborers, as the Germans called them, or slave laborers, or forced laborers, as historians called them, were put to work in the mines, in the mills, in the factories, in the fields. At one point, Hitler worried that the German women were being overworked, instructed his labor minister in Ukraine to bring into Germany Ukrainian girls, as long as they were blonde. He thought if they were blonde, they might have some German Aryan blood in them, to do the work of housekeepers. So there were millions of these. When the war was over, large numbers of displaced persons went home as soon as they possibly could. But a million remained behind in Germany, the last million, which becomes the title of my book. And these were refugees who had no homes to return to, like the Jewish survivors, or refugees who were frightened to go home and preferred to remain at least for the time being in Germany.
Yeah. These refugees or displaced persons, as they were termed in the parlance of the day, when we think of them, we tend to think simply of the survivors of the Holocaust in the camps. That was certainly one group, but there were other groups as well, which you've sort of alluded to, but I think you say there were three distinct groups. There were the laborers, who some had come voluntarily early in the war, and then others were conscripted or kidnapped, basically, and brought back to Germany. Tell us about these groups.
Yeah, the largest group were the forced laborers. In the beginning of the war, German propaganda in Poland was such that a significant number of young Poles were told that they could come to Germany on six-month contracts and work in Germany and get high wages that they could send home to support their families. Poland was devastated after the German invasion, and these young people thought they were doing their families a favor. The same thing happened in the Ukraine. But rapidly, very rapidly, it became clear that these were not contracts, that they would not be allowed to return home after 6 months, that they were forced to wear on their clothing large letters signifying that they were not Germans, and the voluntary recruitment stopped, and Nazi officials began to forcibly deport millions of Poles, Ukrainians, Yugoslavs. So that was the largest number of the displaced persons who remained in Germany, who of the last million. There's another group that comes, and they come under very different circumstances. These are the Latvians, the Lithuanians, and the Estonians. Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia had been briefly, for a year, under the control of the Soviets. Then the Germans invaded, and they took over the land, these three nations. And in 1944 and 1945, tens of thousands of residents of these Baltic nations fled in advance of the Red Army. The Germans were about to be thrown out of those nations. The Red Army was going to occupy them again. And tens of thousands of civilians who had collaborated in one way or another, sometimes innocently working at the post office that was run by a German official, sometimes not so innocently, having served with the auxiliary police force and rounded up Jews, tens of thousands of Latvians, Lithuanians, and Estonians fled the Red Army because they knew the Red Army would bring with it Soviet officials and they would be punished for their collaboration, their war crimes. And they escaped into Germany where they felt they would be safe from the returning Soviets. The third group that makes up the last million are the Jewish survivors. When, as the war comes to an end, the Germans want to disguise as best they can the brutality and the murder and the what would later be known as the Holocaust. So they closed down, buried their concentration camps and death camps in Poland and in the Baltics, and moved the survivors, death marched them, back into Germany, not to save their lives, but to work them to death, rather than gassing the Jewish survivors at Auschwitz and Birkenau. They would put them to work in underground mines and underground factories that were supposed to produce miracle weapons to end the war. Hundreds of thousands were death marched back into Germany. Half of them would die along the way, and large numbers would die underground in these factories.
You know, and immediately after the war, there was another group of Jewish displaced persons. They were had been perhaps in the Soviet Union and worked in the Soviet Union forced labor and labor camps there. Once the war's over, the Soviet Union ships them back, sometimes Polish Jews and Ukrainian Jews and the like. And also those who had hid out during the war, they also come to Germany.
Exactly. The only Polish Jews, or the vast majority of Polish Jews that survived the war, survive it because they were able to cross the borders into the Soviet Union. The Soviets, in dire need of laborers, shipped the Jews and non-Jewish Poles who had crossed the border into Asiatic Soviet Union, where they put them to work. They put them to work in factories, again in mines, producing armaments and producing supplies for the Red Army. When the war was over, Stalin provided trains to bring the Poles back into Poland. And about 200,000 surviving Jews came back to Poland in 1946. They had hoped to reestablish their lives in Poland, as had the Jews who had hidden out in Poland during the war, and as had numbers of concentration camp survivors who, as soon as they were freed from their camps, as soon as liberation came, went back to Poland to look for surviving family members. All of these Polish Jews, or nearly all of these Polish Jews, were horrified to find that their houses, their apartments, their shops, their farms had been taken over by non-Jewish Poles who refused to give back to the Jews what had been taken from them. There was violence, anti-Semitic violence. There were pogroms. There was a level of hostility that the Jews recognized was such that they could not remain in Poland any longer. And through 1946, there is this exodus from Poland across the borders through Austria and through Czechoslovakia back into Germany. How ironic that the only place for the surviving Polish Jews was displaced persons camps in Germany, the land of their murderers, where they could at least be fed, sheltered, and protected by the American troops.
One of the things that is interesting about your book is you debunk and destruct a contemporary notion that I think most Americans have and most people have about the liberation of the concentration camps, that their discovery revealed the final solution, if you will, the extent of the Holocaust. But you write, Edward R. Murrow's famous first report from the camps, he doesn't mention Jews. Neither do most of the newspaper accounts. And in fact, what you write is there were little to no distinctions in how Jews were treated compared to any other displaced person upon liberation.
Yeah.
Why did that happen?
Well, the first thing we have to remember is that most of the Jews had been killed, had been slaughtered. So when the camps were opened, the German camps, large numbers of the inmates of these camps were Poles, were Eastern Europeans, were political prisoners, were homosexuals, were gypsies. That's the first thing, because the Jews had been killed. But secondly, the Jews were so weak, so malnourished, so ill, and spoke only Yiddish, large numbers of them, that they were easy to overlook. And when Edward R. Murrow, and when the journalists, newspaper journalists, went into the camps after liberation, they interviewed the French POWs, the political prisoners, the Belgians who had been left behind, you know, the Brits who had ended up in the concentration camps at the end of the war. And there was no notice given to the Jews. There were long lists of nationalities who were in the concentration camps. And very few of those who wrote about or took newsreels or produced radio programs mentioned the fact that the Jews were the survivors. Mm. In the United States, when it became clear what Hitler had done, there were immediately fears that all the Jews had been wiped out. And it was... You know, it was the Jewish chaplains, the army chaplains. The army had Jewish, Catholic, and Protestant chaplains. And the Jewish chaplains, when they went into the camps, many of them spoke Yiddish, and they searched the camps for the Jews and discovered the Jews, who were, again, the sickliest, the most malnourished, barely able to speak. They couldn't speak to the journalists, but they were able to speak to the Jewish chaplains. And the Jewish chaplains then wrote back to their families, to their synagogues, to their local newspapers, to their congressmen, saying, what about the Jews? They have, the small number of them that have survived, have been damaged, have suffered more than any of the others, and they deserve extra aid and comfort and support. But theirs were, in the beginning, the only voices that recognized the presence of large numbers of Jewish survivors.
You write, in the immediate post-war displaced person camps, DPs were sorted by nationality. In fact, they were sorted by nationality for a good portion of their time in camps. And you would have Polish Jews with Polish non-Jews, many of whom might have been guards in the camps. You had captors housed with captives. I just have a hard time imagining that.
Yeah, yeah. The American Army and the British Army and the United Nations officers who were supposed to take care of the refugees determined very early on that they were going to give no special treatment to any of the groups. Because the Jews were not a national group, the army didn't recognize their existence as Jews. They were Lithuanians, they were Latvians, they were Poles, they were Yugoslavs first, and Jews second. So when the Allies in the UN brought together the displaced persons, and we got to remember that Germany was just devastated. There were all the journalists and the soldiers entering Germany after, as the war came to an end, there were millions of starving, homeless, shelterless civilians, German civilians, and then these emaciated people wandering the streets, in the train stations, in the marketplaces, begging for food or stealing. And the Allies, in order to maintain some sense of order and civilization, rounded them up, all the refugees, and shipped them off to these displaced persons camps where they could be taken care of and gotten off the streets and fed. And they were also worried that the displaced persons were going to spread typhus among the German civilians. But when they sorted them out, by nationality, by their former place of residence. So the Lithuanians, Jews, ended up with Lithuanians who may have been their camp guards. The Poles ended up with Poles whose families may have stolen their property from them. You know, it was an inhumane mess. And when Truman found out about it, because Truman sent an investigator to look into the camps, Truman, who comes off in this book as a bit naive, but as a man who tried to do the right thing, he contacted Eisenhower, another man who tried desperately to do the right thing. And Eisenhower went into the camps, and he left instructions that the Jews were to have their own camps, their own quarters, their own residences, and were to be given extra rations and extra medical supplies, and that Yiddish-speaking chaplains and aid workers were to be sent in to help these poor people recover.
My guest today is David Nassau, Professor Emeritus of History at City University of New York. His latest book is titled The Last Million, Europe's Displaced Persons from World War to Cold War. And that is very evident that from World War, we went to Cold War immediately. And throughout the book, you definitely move from personal stories to the geopolitics of the displaced persons question. And what becomes very evident is these people who, for the most part, suffered tremendously, who were pawns during the war, remain pawns in the post-war period. The first proposals for DPs is that they should return to their home country. I can't imagine a German Jew feeling at home in Germany, but you mentioned how Polish Jews were treated when they tried to come home. I imagine the same was true for, you know, Bulgarian Jews, for Hungarian Jews, for Austrian Jews, for any Jew.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The Jewish survivors, with a few exceptions, the Bundists and the hoped that they would be able to create a Jewish community in Poland like the one that had been there before. But the vast number of Jews wanted nothing to do with Europe anymore. They recognized that the Nazis had destroyed them, but no one or very few in their hometowns and their home countries had tried to save them. And they realized that if Judaism were to survive, if Jews were to be able to raise their families and prosper and escape another Holocaust, it had to be outside of Europe. And they wanted to leave. Large numbers of them wanted to come to the United States because they had family members in the United States who had prospered, and they knew there was a Jewish community in the United States. But it quickly became clear that that was not going to happen. And one of the saddest parts of the story I tell, certainly sad for me, was the decisions of the American Congress to keep the Jews out. It took 3 years for the American Congress to pass the Displaced Persons Act that gave visas to the displaced persons. But the act was written in such a way that 90% of the Jewish DPs were deemed ineligible for these visas. Under the Displaced Persons Act, it was much easier for a war criminal or a collaborator who had disguised his past and snuck into the DP camps, it was much easier for them to get into the United States under false papers if they were from Latvia or the Ukraine or Lithuania than it was for the Jews, than it was for the Polish Jews.
And that was another story, is how the displaced persons were infiltrated by people who had actually committed atrocities, who had been camp guards, who had rounded up Jews in Poland and in the Baltic states and in the Ukraine and in Belarus and various places. They had been put into some SS-like units, or at least units that resembled that, and they're among the displaced persons that were being dispersed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, let me just tell two stories. One is that large numbers, Great Britain suffered an enormous labor shortage after the war, and they recruited all sorts of, tens of thousands of Latvians and Lithuanians, women to work in the tuberculosis sanitaria where no English women or Scottish women would work, and men to work in the mines and to do hard labor. The British coal miners, when they discovered that some of these foreigners, these displaced persons, when they saw that they had Waffen-SS tattoos in their armpits, the Waffen-SS gave everyone a tattoo, including the members of the Latvian and Estonian Waffen-SS foreign legions. The coal miners demanded they went on strike. They wouldn't work with people who had killed their brothers during the war. And the British government response was not to throw out the former Waffen-SS units or to try them for war crimes or to send them back to Germany, but their response was simply to divert all of these Waffen-SS members into jobs where they would not have to take off their shirts and no one would see their tattoos.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, and there's a second story, if I can tell briefly. Coming over on a ship that in 1949 brought some of the displaced persons to the United States was one of the few lucky Jews, a man named Hermann Bornkraut. And on the ship over, he saw a camp guard who had tortured people by the name of Albertus Boros. And on landing in New York, he told the INS officials, you know, seize that man. And the INS officials grabbed Boros, and they took him into custody. And they held him in custody. They let his family go. They held him in custody for 2 years because they discovered, and he had indeed admitted, that he had been a guard in a camp. And then joined the Waffen-SS. After 2 years, the government let him go and let him return to civilian life in Connecticut, where he lived out the rest of his life, never punished for his war crimes. So this is an indictment. This is part of, you know, you mentioned the quick transition from World War to Cold War. Well, what happens is that Americans forget the atrocities of World War rather rapidly, and they replace them with fears of a coming Cold War, so that ex-Nazis become less dangerous, less evil than communists. I mean, there's equations are made between, I mean, Stalin commits crimes against humanity, but he's not Hitler. And, you know, the Soviets are not Nazis, and yet the equation is made, And we forgive the crimes of the Nazi collaborators in order to put all our attention on keeping out potential communists.
And in this case, keeping out Jews who lived in Eastern Europe or in part of what was the Soviet Union, who had been persecuted under the Soviet regime as well as the Nazi regime.
Absolutely. You know, one of the oldest of anti-Semitic myths is this myth that all Jews, you know, are either millionaires or communists, corrupt businessmen or subversives. And in Congress, between 1945 and 1950, a coalition of Midwestern Republicans and Southern Democrats claim, without any evidence, that they can't let the Jewish survivors into this country because they had spent time in the Soviet Union or had come from Poland or had relatives in Poland, which was now dominated by the Soviets, and therefore they were Bolsheviks. They resurrected this myth that all Jews are Bolsheviks at heart, and all Bolsheviks are Jews. And we have to keep the Jews out because they're going to be a danger to the Republic. Nothing could have been less true. But this falsehood determined policy and kept out the Jews.
One last question. You write that this refugee crisis that you write about in The Last Million really paved the way for how the world would handle future refugee crises in the 20th century and even today in the 21st century. What is the worst lesson we learned from The Last Million?
I think the lesson we learned was to treat the victims of war as less than human, as people who had been so damaged by war that they could not reclaim their place in civilization, in the civilized world. That's number one. And number two, we allowed ourselves as Americans to be fed lies about these refugees, lies that we shouldn't let in the Poles because they were lazy, and we shouldn't let in the Jews because they were probably communists or communist subversives. Lies should not determine public policy in this country. And geopolitical Cold War politics should not have been allowed then to override the humanitarian concerns that are at the basis of American dreams and American civilization.
The name of the book is The Last Million. David Nassau, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
David Nassau is a professor emeritus of history at the City University of New York. His latest book is titled The Last Million, Europe's Displaced Persons from World War to Cold War. It's published by Penguin. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.